I'm Benjamin Wittes, editor-in-chief of Lawfare.
And I'm Susan Hennessy, managing editor of Lawfare.
You're listening to Rational Security on the ER podcast feed.
For more of our columns and exclusive Lawfare content, read us at foreignpolicy.com.
I'm so glad nothing happened while we were all on vacation.
Yeah, we picked the right week, didn't we?
Yeah, great week to take off.
So, you know, we had, so were you in Charlottesville for your vacation?
No, I was not. It was a second thought. We went somewhere else. Went to Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
And how was it?
Portsmouth is a lovely, lovely town.
Any white supremacist violence there?
Not that I could detect.
Although there are white supremacists in New Hampshire.
There probably are a few.
And they live free or die.
They sure do. And they have great bars in Portsmouth. And I had quite an adventure with scotch.
Very yeah. Appropriate.
Do you tell?
Coconut washed squash. Wait.
What?
Yes.
What?
Scotch, washed scotch.
You can't even say
what is it.
Coconut
mean?
What? So you take scotch and apparently you put coconut oil in the scotch and shake it up and you let it like sit and swirl around for a couple of weeks. And then you skim off the oil, which rises to the top. And the coconut scotch is infused with this delicate flavor of coconut and you use it in sort of tropical-y drinks.
This seems like an abomination.
It totally does, except when you taste it, and then it seems like a revelation.
So wait, what did you put it in?
I forget what drink exactly it was in, but it was delicious. I'd had a few by that time.
A pina wow. scotch colada?
A pina scolada.
That sounds terrible.
But I did not feel terrible.
Right, tweet your outrage at Shane about this, people.
Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Everything Old is New Again edition. I'm Shane Harris, rested, rejuvenated reporter, back in the swamp.
You do. You look tan, calm, happy.
I feel very calm right now. It'll probably last for about 24 more hours.
No, not even that.
Have you been on the internet yet?
Did something happen?
Well, can I just say, like lots of stuff has happened, but in... our areas, you know, like the areas that we've all been focused on, it's been eerily quiet.
It hasn't like, been like a
no
Russia
big
show.
Mueller news, no big, yeah. You know, Trump o'clock, Russia revelations.
Your canon has been silent.
The canon's been quiet. It's yeah. It's been, you know, there was that one great Adam Davidson story in The New Yorker, but other than that, and that's a week ago. And so it's
and we're not going to war with North Korea yet, as far
for
as
now.
We can tell.
For now.
And, you know, we're just mildly escalating the longest war in American history.
No I did have deal. A lot of national security related dreams while I was gone.
That's bad, Shane.
Including one that like George W. Bush was secretly contacting me about something that Trump was doing with Iran.
That wasn't a dream. That was true.
I woke up was like, wait, am I reporting on something?
Yeah. That really happened.
That really happened. I am here, of course, in the studio with my friend Susan Hennessy, Ben Wittes, and Tamara Kaufman Wittes. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
We are
we
back.
Missed you.
Oh, I missed you guys too. Well, some things did happen in the past couple of days, and we're going to talk about that. President Trump has unveiled his new plan for Afghanistan. Kind of feels like the old plan. We're going to talk about that. Cyber Command gets a big boost and is now a full-fledged combatant command. You're
it's
a
all
real boy,
it's
Cyber
all grown
Command.
Up.
And Cyber Command is all grown up.
It ate its spinach and grew big and strong.
And speaking of grown-ups, Steve Bannon has been shown the door at the White House. We'll talk about what that portends for national security policy making, such that it is in the administration. Let's start with the Afghanistan plan. Lighting into his generals, telling them that we're losing in Afghanistan, demanding that we win. Trump finally accedes to their plan to basically send more troops. This looks a lot like the plan that we've had for maybe the past 16 years. We can talk about that. Tamara, why don't you kick us off? What are your first reactions to what this proposed announced strategy is, which we know very little about the specifics, but... seems like in the specifics, it feels pretty familiar.
It does feel pretty familiar, and it's unlikely to produce any results that are radically different from those that we've seen in previous iterations. But I do think it's worth noting that this is a president who came into office very much on the record repeatedly in wanting to pull out of Afghanistan, seeing this as a loser. And that, you know, starting position was part of the sort of pendulum swing that we've seen between George W. Bush, Obama, and then Trump, you know, whether Afghanistan was the good war or the forgotten war. the good war or the loser war. Obama came into office thinking it was the good war, but by the time he left, didn't have a clear path to victory and was, you know, really focused on trying to end the combat role for the United States. But as we've seen in Iraq as well as in Afghanistan, if the U.S. And the local government are not working closely together, not just on military operations, but on governance and rule of law and the underlying conditions that prevent the resurgence of terrorism, lo and behold, terrorism reemerges. And we've seen in the Afghanistan case in recent months, not only the resurgence of the Taliban, not only the emergence of an ISIS affiliate in Afghanistan engaging in more operations, increases of bombings and attacks in Kabul, but we've also seen other states taking advantage of these developments to the detriment of American interests. The Russians reportedly selling weapons to the Taliban or providing weapons to the Taliban. The Pakistanis kind of slacking off on their commitments to the United States to constrain cross-border movement and support for groups that are affiliated with terrorist activities in Afghanistan. So, look, it's a crappy situation with no good options. And I think that, you know, what the U.S., what the military commanders came up with and presented to the president again and again and again over his repeated objections is the best that they can do. They know there's no support in the U.S. public for a major escalation. And they can't promise that even a major escalation will, quote, win the war, unquote. And so they're basically saying, give us a few more troops. We'll do a little bit more on the military side. And the big bet is that on the political, economic, you know, diplomatic side, the work can get done to make Afghanistan stable.
It feels like a marketing pitch. I mean, it feels like there is no appreciable difference in what is being sold here. It's just that there's a new salesman.
But it is interesting that once again, we've been through a cycle of Trump coming in to sort of a longstanding national security problem. We've talked about this in relation to North Korea, sort of contemplating very disruptive options, sort of doing his Trump thing, and then ultimately being convinced to take sort of that sane, you know, middle ground path that kind of the establishment players are pushing him towards.
Yeah, the conventional path.
I mean, do we have any counterexamples in which he actually has meaningfully deviated from that sort of that safe center space?
Yes, we do. The Paris Climate Agreement.
Sure. I'm not on national security, but...
Well, I mean, you know...
I think the military would say, they have said explicitly that climate change is a national security issue.
I think to Susan's point, it's like he's not coming up with, I've got a new plan that I'm going to implement in defiance of
your
plan.
It's more like he loses his nerve, right? He sort of, he has all this bluster, he says all these things, but it sounds like he really does listen to the generals, that those national security advisors do have his ear in some kind of way that gets results.
Yeah, but I think... that's maybe a little bit too generous to him. So first of all, in a lot of these cases, he does not have developed policy ideas to begin with. What he has is rage that we're not winning and rage that other people are getting the better of us. And he hasn't considered options well enough to have a sense of how current policy in fact weighs against other options. And so when he when he actually is forced to do so, what he tends to find is that, you know, he's not sophisticated enough to frame it this way, but that winning and losing is not a binary, it's a spectrum, and that policy is about optimizing outcomes, and that, you know, that current policy is not that far from the point of at least expected optimization. And so he tends to go somewhere near there. The trouble is that he sometimes he doesn't, and sometimes he's not willing to do that that work that he appears to have done here. Look, I would also say in the context of Afghanistan that there is something laudable about what his policy choice has been that I think is, you know, worth highlighting, which is that he's basically decided, and they're all but saying, that this isn't winnable.
Actually, but Tillerson said it. We said can't. Yesterday, we may not win, but the Taliban won't win
right.
either.
That we're fighting. Well, there you go. That we're fighting for a stalemate in order to condition a in order to condition a political process. That is actually a fine policy, and it's a fairly modest policy objective. In a country in which our policy objectives, both under the Bush administration and under the Obama administration, have been a little grandiose at times. And so I do think in this situation, they've kind of evolved in a pretty respectable direction.
So I think I agree with you, Ben, in the sense that this is probably the most, quote, realist, unquote, policy that the Trump administration has put forward on a major national security issue. But I have two big buts. The first but is that they are increasing American troop commitments, and they're doing it in a way that is not honest and straightforward with the American people first so far about how many troops they're going to add. And second, without a clear strategy for victory. So you're telling the American people, I am deciding as the president of the United States to send more of our men and women into harm's way, but I can't explain to you in an articulate or credible manner how that's going to make a difference to our national security and our national interests. We're going to fight terrorists. We're going to kill terrorists. And I think that the lack of clear strategic articulation is compounded by the many months in which Trump has eroded his credibility as a truth speaker to the American people and his moral credibility to send troops into harm's way. The second but is very much related, which is that to the extent that it is the strategy you describe, Ben, it hinges on things that this administration denigrates, defunds, actively devalues, and when it tries to use them, screws them up, i.e. diplomacy and development. Okay, because you can't simply kill the terrorists to a stalemate. You can push them back and then use it for diplomacy. But Tillerson is horrific at this, as we've seen in case after case. The State Department is dismantled. In fact, Tillerson had dismantled the SRAP office, the Afghanistan and Pakistan office, until he was forced by public disclosure to reverse that decision. And, you know, They're not going to be able to mobilize a whole lot of new assistance for Afghanistan to incentivize the behavior that they want to see when they're cutting the aid budget by 30%. So the pieces are not in place for that realist strategy to succeed. And what that says to me is he's fooling people, and maybe he's even fooling himself. Afghanistan is a place where Trump's rhetoric about terrorism, which is that you just kill the bad guys and that's how you win, falls down flat.
I think the point about the sort of the moral credibility is a really important one. This is one of the first times we've seen Trump really undertake that sort of like that task that requires lots and lots of public faith and trust. And that's saying, you know, I'm going to send more people into harm's way, especially coming sort of right on the heels of Charlottesville, where it feels like he is at his most depleted. I mean, who knew that there could be a bottom lower than where we were? It was such a remarkable, jarring contrast. One, the non-disclosure of the relevant facts, like how many people do you have in mind here? And at the same time, sort of the, you know, trust me with people's lives, trust me to take to understand the gravity of this decision, and trust me to follow through in a responsible way. And he just didn't have any of it. And so all I really saw in response, beyond sort of the substantive critiques of it not being a different policy, were people sort of applauding him for being able to read off a teleprompter and not say something horrifying for, you know, a 15-minute speech.
Can I ask you guys one question about this, though, which is about the role of McMaster and Mattis in the wake of the announcement? Like, typically, okay, Trump is describing this as a military forward operation. He's increasing troop deployments. Why isn't the Secretary of Defense out on the national networks talking to the American people? Why is it Secretary of State Tillerson, who is, you know, constrained in his own ways, giving the press conference the next day? Where is the National Security Advisor in public messaging on this? And, you know, if we don't trust President Trump as someone with the moral credibility to make this case to the American people, how do we feel about Secretary of Defense Mattis or National Security Advisor McMaster at this point? Is their moral credibility impeded?
It's a really good question. I mean, you haven't seen the kind of full-on rollout, I think, that you might see.
In a more organized administration.
This magnitude, which also might speak, it could speak possibly to Trump wanting to be the one in front of this. We know that he likes to go out and to make those announcements and make those decisions and proclamations. We don't wait till Sunday. I mean, it could be that they go wall-to-wall on the Sunday shows.
I also think this is something that nobody quite wants to own. Because the president, it is a real walk back from his actual position and from his original position. And to his credit, he was candid about that in the speech. Yeah. And I actually thought my praise for him is not generally existent, but I think we have to give him credit for that. He walked out and
they wrote it for him and he was willing to read it.
You know, that's true of most presidents most of the time. He had a very strong position in the campaign, and he looked a camera in the eye and said, I take it back. It's different. And I he didn't say he was wrong, because that's actually
asking. He said it's different when you sit behind the desk, which is what everyone told me would be true.
Right. And so I think we got to give him a little bit of credit for that. That said, I'm sure he's not real proud of this, and this isn't what he wants to be talking about. Yeah. From military's point of view, this is not a strategy to win. It's a strategy to stalemate, and that's not something that they're going to be out there yelling about enthusiasm. And I'm sure they would have wanted more troops than they got.
However many that may be,
right?
We still don't know.
And with respect to Tillerson, he doesn't really seem to want to be out front of anything, except dismantling the State Department. Exactly who would be the person who would run point on this?
I mean, I also think there's a feature of this that really isn't that related to Trump, and that's just the general fatigue among the American public. You know, we're 16 years into this. Let's face it, this is how press coverage has been for the past, you know, 5-6 years, which is there are periodic sort of flurries of reporting about Afghanistan, and then we kind of forget about it and say, oh, that's right, Afghanistan's still going on, huh?
Like, 16 years.
Go figure.
Only possible because it's an all-volunteer military.
Yeah.
Right. And that would likely be a feature of any president. Certainly their particular inclination, I agree that, you know, nobody wants to own this, but I also don't think there's this ravenous hunger among the American people for a clear articulation of the Afghanistan.
Okay. Sad but true.
Speaking of ravenous hungers, cyber.
That was a very good transition, Shane.
Cyber Command, its ravenous ways, is now Cyber Command is now a full-fledged combatant command.
It's all growed up.
For those who don't follow the intricacies of military hierarchy, Cyber Command had been a subordinate command under Strategic Command.
Strategic Command.
Right.
That's the one. One of those S's.
The one with the missiles.
And
is sort of joined at the hip with the National Security Agency, which has the talent and capabilities and all those kinds of things that Cyber Command uses. But this is an important step, not an unexpected one. Susan, I'll go to you first as the resident NSA-er in the room. Not unexpected, but talk a bit about the significance of elevating it to this position. And it presages an eventual split from the NSA, we think, as well, no?
Yeah. So look, none of this is surprising. This was long expected under the Obama administration. This was something that was seriously considered first in 2013, was sort of determined as premature, then again was seriously considered in 2016, sort of as they were leaving office. And for reasons that weren't necessarily clear, it was decided not to do it at this time. So this is really sort of in the bucket of kind of an inevitability. So there are two parts to sort of the NSA cybercom future story. One is the elevation of of cyber command to a full unified command, right? So it becomes, you know, co-equal with STRATCOM. The other is the breaking of the dual hat. So at the moment, there is a single individual who sits, who is both the commander of cyber command and also the director of NSA. So is Admiral Mike Rogers right now, previously was General Alexander. So there has, for a lot of different reasons, been sort of a belief that that was not a sustainable situation for the long term. Part of that is organizational because of the particular equities and relationships and sort of weird things that happen when two very different organizations happen to share the same person as a boss. There's also issues of just of resource allocation. So the Obama administration had always sort of put it forward as you were going to do these two things at the same time. They'd also had a third feature, which is that the eventual director of the NSA, the new director of the NSA post-dual hat, would be a civilian. It can't be a civilian now because you have to be the commander of cyber command as well. And so that would be a civilian in the future, and that was sort of like a give to civil libertarians. This was viewed as sort of a privacy-enhancing a sort of feature. So what the Trump administration has done is decided to take things one at a time. So there's one thing that the president can just do on his own, and that's order the elevation of cyber command. He doesn't need congressional approval. He doesn't need anything else. He just orders it. And so that's what Trump went ahead and did. The breaking of the dual hat is more complicated because back in 2014 in the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, Congress put a bunch of conditions saying you can't break the dual hat until you certify X, Y, and Z. So that means that Trump can't just say, and I'm going to break the dual hat. He has to get congressional buy-in as well.
Thanks, John McCain.
Exactly. Basically, thanks, John McCain, almost individually. He's been very, has really owned this issue for a number of years and has changed his position a couple times in terms of whether or not he thought it was premature or ready. So that's where we are now. Trump has ordered the elevation of to the unified command. That is happening. And then he's ordered SecDef to undertake a 60-day review about the breaking of the dual hat. So in 60 days, NSA and DOD will make an announcement. I think everybody expects the announcement to be, we're going to separate the dual hat. Then the real question is, will you still have a civilian as the next person? Trump doesn't have those civil liberty, warm, fuzzy feelings. It's much easier for him to control a military officer. So I think a number of sort of observers think he's just going to put a military person at the head of NSA.
Ben, or he could put a former military person at the head of NSA. Right.
He likes those former generals. Once a general, always a general. I mean, Ben, from a practical standpoint, I mean, is this, how do you think that this changes the mission or the good functioning of cyber command? I mean, elevating it in this way, does it make it more likely that it's going to succeed in its mission, or is that not the point?
So I would defer to Susan on that, but I guess my instinct is, first of all, I think it's a very significant change, and the breaking of the dual hat would be an even more significant change. And the reason is that the way we think about what we call NSA, what we call NSA sort of includes cyber command. We think about them as an integrated entity because the leader is dual-hatted and of both. And that is a reflection of the personality and individual influence of Keith Alexander, which was looms very large over the subsequent history of both cyber
and
command.
And someone in this room wrote a very good book about.
Yes, indeed. And
Shane, you know, wrote the book.
And I think, you know, part of the way to understand this is that once General Alexander is out of office, there's this kind of, well, what do you do about NSA cyber command? And that question was there when he was there, but he was sufficiently admired and valued and essential that you could kind of defer the thing. And I think we're dealing a little bit with what happens to the agencies now that he's not there anymore. And I think that's sort of the background. And do we really want to think of these as an integrated project, or do we want to think of them as two projects? I think the answer is emerging that we want to think of them as two projects. And certainly the cyber domain is worthy of elevation to the full primary command level.
I mean, I agree with that. I do. I think there are some things that people, some current failures of Cyber Command that people are sort of saying this is going to fix that probably isn't going to fix. So one of the things the Obama administration was rather unhappy about was the failure to make progress in sort of the cyber fight against ISIS. That's a really, really hard thing to do that isn't necessarily related to some of the issues of, mm-hmm. of sort of the co-location. And I think that's a tough challenge. It's a tougher challenge than anyone really understood at the outset, and it's going to endure as a tough challenge. That said, you know, that the jobs are not the same, and the job sometimes is intention, and that's that the job of the NSA is signals intelligence. It's collecting information. The job of Cyber Command is offensive cyber operations. And so this sort of this notion of deconfliction, you find a target and then you have to make a choice. Do you blow it up so you can't use it anymore? Or do you keep it intact so that you can collect off of it?
Blow it up.
We know which organization Ben would work for. Yeah, there is, some people have sort of, Bobby Chesney has talked a lot about that inherent tension. A lot of people have said, oh, it's not that overstated. But I think it's obvious on its face that when you're the boss of both of those places, like you have to favor one or the other. The other sort of issue that's less, I think, I don't know, like appealing in the civil sibling rivalry sense is the other parts of the military that have felt like Cyber Command got too much of NSA's attention. NSA is supposed to be combat support to the entire United States military, but, you know, little brother or big brother or whoever it is, that guy sitting right next to them, it turns out, got a disproportionate amount of time and attention.
So can I ask a logistics question about, you know, breaking up the sibling rivalry? Does Cyber Command have to move out?
I hope so, because parking is a nightmare. I don't know. I don't think necessarily it has to. My understanding was that was sort of the assumption, only because last time we went through this, people were like drawing up plans for other people's offices. So that was
finally going to get the office next to the window
of like who was getting in on their space.
So just as for one more
strange base in a strange place is now saved from closure by the elevation of Cyber Command.
Reader service of the people who work at NSA Cyber Command headquarters. How many of them work for NSA? How many of them work for Cyber Command? I mean, is this like you're going to like empty out the Fort Meade buildings, or like what happens? Like how?
No, I mean, I do think it'll significantly alleviate resources. And I don't know the plan for the co-location. And I actually would suspect there's not a firm plan at the moment, because they're going to do this review as part of it. Cyber Command is smaller. I could like ballpark, but it would honestly be a guess, 30% of people there, something like that, a non-insignificant presence.
That would include
cafeteria lines.
Yeah. It is, right. And this is the things that really matter to the day-to-day security.
The parking would be way better.
Exactly. Yeah.
There are no small roles, only small people.
And small hands.
Speaking of small hands.
another segue.
Steve Bannon, we hardly knew you.
Segway King.
That's me. That's me. Some people ride a Segway. Some people
just have ride a Segway. Flawless transitions.
Yeah. Steve Bannon, not that I think anybody really thought that he was probably hanging on for that much longer, but Steve Bannon is officially out at the White House.
Bye-bye.
There is a initial political response to this question about what does this do for, you know, Trump with the alt-right, and now that Steve Bannon is out back at Breitbart, and he said he has his hands on his weapons, I think, in an interview with the Weekly Standard. What kind of political threat would
Anthony
he be?
Scaramucci say about that?
Yeah. Where is that guy now? Jeez. He's hanging out with Steve Mnuchin's wife and managing her Instagram feed. Go check it out if that seems obscure to you. Anyway, but there's another question here, I think, from a practical process standpoint on national security, which is, one way to look at this is, now that Steve Bannon is out, will things run a bit more smoothly and coherently on the NSC side?
The triumph of the globalist cucks.
Exactly.
This is going to be the pivot, guys. Right. It's going to change this time.
Bannon, more than just his reputation for being a political, truculent kind of force in the White House, was running what many people thought was a parallel shadow National Security Council through the Strategic Initiatives Group, reportedly was putting his fingerprints on all kinds of executive orders and grabbing things before they went to the president's desk. Probably the most visible manifestation of his influence would be on the travel ban and the kind of botched efforts that went through in the beginning. So, Ben, let me ask you to start with this. But, I mean, with Bannon gone, does that eliminate a kind of a roadblock or a sort of choke point in the National Security Council process, or even, I don't know if I want to go so far as the interagency, but, you know, this is somebody who, you know, was very well known, did not get along with H.R. McMaster, was very much, you know, his nemesis in the White House, and now he's gone. He's out of there.
Right. So I think, first of all, it is always a mistake, 100% of the time, to get excited about staffing changes in the White House under Trump, because the fundamental personality that matters in this White House is Donald Trump. Donald Trump was Donald Trump, as he likes to point out, before Steve Bannon, who came on quite late, and right. Trump is not wrong about that. And the essentials of the Trump personality were well on display long before Steve Bannon was a known figure, much less a figure associated with Donald Trump.
He did not make Donald Trump, as Donald Trump wants us to remember.
Exactly. And Bannon likes to kid himself that this Trump is a creation of Steve Bannon. But in fact, Steve Bannon is a creation of Donald Trump. And so I think, you know, we should all cool it in terms of excitement and Susan's sarcastic insistence that this is the pivot. A lot of people believe some version of that, as that this is a significant event. And in the broad scheme of things, it is not a significant event. There is only one sense in my mind in which, well, two senses, one very small, which is that to the extent that appears to be a concentration of power in a respectable process under serious people at the staff level going on, and both McMaster at NSC and Kelly as chief of staff are examples of that and are trying to do that. That means that you can imagine a process existing that would reserve the insanity till later in the process. It won't get rid of it, because eventually the president is still going to tweet whatever is on his mind and he's going to do whatever he wants to do. But you can defer insanity until later in the process and concentrate it in the hands of one person rather than diffuse it among lots of people. The more significant effect, I think, is that to the extent that Bannon decides to, as he puts it, go to war with his enemies in the White House, you could really imagine this triggering some degree of detachment on chiefly on foreign policy issues and sort of nationalism issues of some segment of the Trumpist base from the White House. And I think that is a significant political possibility. I don't know that it has White House functioning questions, except in terms of their ability to hold on to their base.
Yeah, so I think that's a really important point and something as a political matter that we need to keep our eyes on, because it's not in fact true either that Bannon created Trump or that Trump created Bannon. Bannon and Breitbart were part of a political phenomenon that Trump then rode to the presidency, you know, at the end with a bit of Bannon's direct help, but they're part of the same ecosystem. And so to the extent that Bannon does decide to aggressively contradict or go to war with, in his colorful phrasing, you know, the White House, then it could have interesting political effects. But in policy terms, process aside, I think Ben's diagnosis of the likely impact on the process is right. It delays the chaos and squarely puts it on the president's desk. And maybe we'll all get a break from the sort of soap opera stories about inside the White House backbiting, hallway sniping, gossip, whatever.
Which Steve Bannon was a major source.
Yeah, and frankly, it's exhausting and not insightful and not even very relevant, because the president is still the decider. And so maybe it'll be clarifying to everybody that the problem is, in fact, the president. But in policy terms, what I think is most important about Bannon's brief presence in the White House and his departure is not only the immigration ban, which you noted, Shane, but there are a couple other issues on which he had major, major stakes and on which he tried to play. On one, he was largely successful. On the other, he largely failed. China. He wanted a trade war with China. He wanted major confrontation with China as America's, you know, global competitor. He didn't get it. And I would say he lost that battle right at the beginning of the administration with a fairly successful presidential visit, the establishment of the strategic dialogue, placing it pretty much in Tillerson's hands. And so the sort of U.S.-China process of looking for ways to work together is what has defined that relationship, not confrontation. The other big issue, though, is America's relations with Europe and with NATO allies. And there, Bannon pretty much got what he wanted. The damage there has been done. The trust has been broken. That Trump trip to Europe was absolutely decisive. And the impact on European politics was immediate. Now, ultimately, several European electorates rejected the populist candidates that Bannon wanted to fuel with this kind of approach. But they did that on their own, not because the United States helped in any way. And I think that the relationship between the U.S. and its NATO allies, going back to our first segment, especially as we are now ramping up in Afghanistan, the fact that those relations are so fractured, so mistrustful, we're going to be paying the price for that years into the future. And that's going to be the lasting legacy of Steve Bannon.
And you've still got Sebastian Gorka and Stephen Miller, who are his closest allies in that effort in the White House.
True. But beyond kind of public rhetoric, I don't know that they have any meaningful impact.
He likes his public rhetoric.
He does.
Dr. Gorka.
He does indeed. No, I mean, I think that's largely, I agree with both everything Ben and Tammy said. I mean, I think this is not the pivot. This is not the moment in which Trump becomes president. And we start seeing this like smoothly functioning White House. You know, I mean, like
it's a well-oiled machine.
And just seeing the, General Kelly has gotten lots of sort of credit for bringing calm for the past 2 weeks, I guess. Seeing that rally last night, it's really difficult to imagine the conversation that's going on in John Kelly's head about why exactly he continues to serve. There was this sort of an interesting, I can't remember, I think it was maybe Axios the New York Times that wrote a piece about sort of the people who are still inside and why they continue to serve, and saying, you don't know how many crazy ideas we kill, and sort of this continuing narrative of there being adults in the room and sort of this
it
calming
could be so
presence.
Much worse. Yeah,
exactly. And so I do think that pushing out highly visible, highly symbolic people like Steve Bannon is a win. I think it helps those people feel like, they can sort of sleep at night their views are ultimately going to prevail. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that it's not, that isn't just sort of self-justification of, you could walk down that path kind of forever with the president. It's not clear to me what exactly the limiting principle is on that thinking. Whether or not Bannon goes to war via Breitbart, I don't actually care. Like, I don't think it's going to be that interesting. I'm sure I'll get a lot of headlines. Whether it actually changes policy or chaos in the White House, I just, like Ben said, the issue is the president. It's not anybody else.
All right, let's move on to object lessons. Ben, do you want to go first?
I have many objects.
Many
today.
Objects.
Objects.
The Jungle Studio is filled with all the objects.
Filled with all the objects.
It is filled with many objects, I'll tell you that much.
So, first of all, I have to thank people for these objects. People have been sending me objects. a gentleman I've never met sent me a lovely little baby Canon lapel pin, which
Is Baby Cannon now the mascot of Lawfare?
I don't know if Baby Cannon is sort of more of a me thing than a Lawfare.
It's a personal
thing.
Brand to Benjamin.
Yeah, but because I don't really want to blame, like, implicate Lawfare in the insanity that is Baby Cannon. But suffice it to say that Baby Cannon has fans out there.
You know, some people collect, like, little pig statues, little cats.
Right.
Ben collects
and you could have married one of those people, didn't you?
But people keep sending me little Baby Cannon things. And I loved this Baby Cannon lapel pin. This was sent to me by somebody on Twitter who goes by the name Spaceman Eddie or Spaceman Ed. And I loved this pin so much that I turned around and ordered 100 of them to give people as thank you gifts for things. So Baby Cannon lapel pins are the new thing. You should be wearing one. You know, the way conservatives...
I would have to have lapels.
Used to wear American flag pins.
Exactly.
I think the Society of the Baby Cannon is going to start wearing lapel pins.
All right.
So thank you to Spaceman Ed for that. In addition, I just want to say the person who we quoted, who made the pitch for the mug, who we described as an FBI deep stater, was so touched by winning the mug that she sent us a group of command coins from the Bureau, which we have distributed around Rational Security.
Thank you.
We cannot identify the command coin particularly because that might give a little too much information about who we're talking about. But thank you very much. And finally, a group of various people have been sending me Jim Comey paraphernalia. Cyrus,
you can line it up next to your Putin paraphernalia.
Cyrus Favriar of Ars Technica sent me a great kitchen magnet. Comey, don't play that. And Danielle Zitron of the University of Maryland, where we will be doing a live taping next month, by the way, sent a bunch of Comey is my homie t-shirts. So the swag keeps coming in.
I hope like the Comey children are collecting this all just a hilarious memorabilia.
Yeah, so they
will
roast
cherish.
Dad.
I hope you like got them all like some for Christmas, you know?
Yeah.
Like you're getting sweatshirts with Comey Don't Play That. And you're getting pillows.
You get a mug.
And like and a Mueller Time t-shirt while we're at it.
Yeah, the Mueller Time t-shirts are pretty funny.
Those are pretty great, I have to say. I'm gonna quickly share one object. I think I talked maybe a year or so ago about how I was doing all my family tree research and found all these ancestors, including the Revolutionary War ones. So on our vacation, we actually found the old Kinney burial ground in Griswold, Connecticut, which doesn't have a whole lot going for it. But this burial ground is here as a scenic site. I don't know if you can see it, but like that is a whole very old cemetery.
Wow.
Full of my peeps.
Those are just
those are
like Harris's
peeps
everywhere?
They're Kinneys, actually. So it's my mother's line.
How old?
Family. Well, my seventh great grandfather was apparently interred here in 1756.
Dang, wow. Man.
And that he may be one of the oldest ones in there. And the last person who was buried here was buried in 1913.
Wow.
And so, according to the gravestones, I mean, there are veterans of numerous wars, actually, who are in this. So I thought I'd bring in a picture of this. But this doesn't quite do it. This says it's in this very like peaceful kind of opening with dappled sunshine from a tree canopy, and it's next to a little creek. To reach this, you need to walk past a private house that looks like something from the scene of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which has a right of way next to it, but no trespassing signs posted, which is a little confusing. So you kind of have to walk by this thing and hope that nobody like jumps out and shoots you. Then go through. It's not really so much a path as much as like just kind of like treads worn in the dirt. And if you've ever seen True Detective season 1, where they go into that abandoned, like crumbling edifice called Carcosa, like there's like five of these carcosas that you have to walk through to get there, which apparently was land that was deeded for this cemetery to my family that had all these old buildings on it. And finally you get through like a little broken wall where there's a clearing and there's the cemetery. This thing is made for like kids to hang out on Halloween and freak each other out, which is apparently what happens given like the profusion of liquor and beer bottles and campfire sites and then the rope
Party
swing
Central.
Hanging from a tree that at one point apparently was reached by stepping on old headstones that the local kids stacked up to get to the rope swing.
I just want to say while Shane's family over the centuries was being buried in that cemetery, my family was being killed in pogroms in Russia by Cossacks. So, you know, those two pictures of America right there.
So I have no plans to be buried in the old Kenny burial ground, just so we're clear.
I always imagined like shooting you out of a cannon.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Something dramatic.
Baby cannon.
Fitting. Baby cannon. Baby cannon. I will start planning my funeral arrangements. Oh, but not before, not hopefully not too soon. But we're at the end of the show now, so we do have to say goodbye, a little funeral for this episode.
Dead and buried.
Rational Security is, of course, a production of Spaghetti and Wall Productions. You can find our show archive on our webpage. You can follow us on Facebook. Tweet us. Follow us at RATL Security. Leave us a rating and a review. They really help us out on iTunes or Apple now, I guess it's called, or Stitcher, or wherever you download your podcast. As always, thank you very, very much for all the positive feedback, and it helps others find the show. Our audio engineer this week is Matthew Kahn. Our show is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. Our music this week was performed by Steve Bannon and the Peevish Pivots.
Oh, nice.
I like the Peevish Pivots.
Sounds like a little like a 50s kind of...
Yeah, doo-wop.
Yeah, you know, like the Platters. of course, our music is performed, as always, by Sophia Yan. We hope that she has had some lovely vacation and rest this summer as well. On behalf of my friends Susan Hennessy, Ben Wittes, and Tamara Kaufman Wittes, I'm Shane Harris. We will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.